Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Fulton County Employees Retirement System against MGIC Investments.
May it please the court. Yes. My name is Beth Caswan. I'm with Scott & Scott. I represent the plaintiffs, who are the appellants in this action. We are appealing a dismissal of a securities fraud case that was issued in February 2010 and the denial of leave to amend on futility grounds that was issued in December of 2010.
Before you say anything, is that podium high enough for you?
It is.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. Yes, thank you very much. In this action, the district court dismissed the complaint and refused leave to amend essentially on two grounds. The first being that the statements that were made by MGIC about its about CBAS, which it owned 46% of the stock, were not misleading because they were literally true, and as a result, there was no duty to disclose further facts. The second ground that the district court relied upon was that the omitted information was not material as a matter of law. These findings were incorrect, and on the de novo review by this court should sustain the complaint and or permit leave to amend because the three groups of statements that were made in a press release issued on July 19, 2007, the statements made...
You just mentioned the July 19th statements. Your adversary reads your brief as limiting your claim now to those statements, which is a substantial retrenchment of where things were in the district court. Is that a correct understanding of your current position?
Your Honor, certainly those statements are the ones we're focusing on.
You say focusing on. Are you arguing any other statements?
No, Your Honor, not for purposes of today.
Thank you.
On July 9th, the reason why the complaint should be sustained is that the district is under the authority of the recent U.S. Supreme Court case in Matrix. What Matrix described is that ordinarily, issuers and its officers and directors have no duty to speak if they have remained silent. However, if they have put a matter into play, if they have brought up a issue for discussion with investors, then it has a duty to disclose adverse facts which would reflect that the statements that were made could be viewed in a different light.
I have a sort of a discreet question for you, and it's this. Do you have any facts suggesting that CBAS used the ABX index to value its subprime assets? Because Williams never mentions the ABX index in his statement on the variables used in valuations, unless I missed it.
There are inferences that we believe can be drawn by the statements of the confidential witnesses and also by the fact that the $145 million in margin calls corresponded to a drop by 20% in the ABX index during that same 18-day period. However, in the SEC reports of transcripts, which we received while this case was pending on appeal, there are specific statements by both Draghi and Williams that the reason why they were having problems was that the lenders had changed position and were now marking CBAS's assets against the ABX index. So that with the benefit of the testimony of Draghi and Williams, we have precise evidence on that point, with respect to the complaint that was filed and the proposed amended complaint, we are relying upon inferences to reach that conclusion.
But as long as CBS is following those GAAP principles to arrive at its estimates of values, how do you prove that it intentionally inflated its book value, particularly when you have a situation where the market value for these particular assets it was so difficult to ascertain?
The reason, Your Honor, is that it's not whether the values are subjectively fair or could be viewed differently. The point that Williams made was that the values were verified by the lenders. And if the values had been verified, what that means is that the marks of the lenders are incorporated in the values. And
but,
that was
of course
false.
Lenders are motivated, it seems to me, to assign a low value to the assets, you know, in order to assure the loans will be paid. Does the lenders, you know, the differing valuations really suggest that Williams and Draghi didn't honestly believe that CBAS's book value approximate market value?
That's not the argument, Your Honor. The argument is that the only values that mattered were the lender's values, because the lender's values dictated the margin calls. CBAS had in excess of $6 billion of subprime assets that served as collateral for the lender's loans.
So what information would support the inference that Magic MGIC knew by, I'm going back to where we were, July 19th, what the CBAS lenders had said about the value of the leveraged assets?
The information is that Magic, along with Radian, provided $100 million of the $150 million of cash that the company had on July 19th. What that means is that the only source of liquidity of cash that CBAS had on that date was the extraordinary loans by its parents. It could not borrow money. It could not sell its assets in the ordinary course into the market. It could not securitize them.
You call it its parent, but it's not even a controlling owner of CBAS, is it?
Well, it owns 46%, and it had the...
And I gather another company owned 46%.
That's correct.
So whatever MGIC said went. They needed the consent of the co-owner.
Well, the both...
Doesn't that
they,
cause
they
some
were,
problems?
They
were, trying to talk over me won't help you. Doesn't that cause some problems for your Section 20 theory? How is CBAS controlled when another person had at least equal control?
Well, Your Honor, they had sufficient control to bring Draghi and Williams to the earnings call, who they then put up
I don't understand things like that at all. Apple Computer brings Intel to its earnings call. That doesn't mean that Apple controls Intel.
Yes, but CBAS's results are incorporated into Magic's financial statements that are issued to public investors. So it's not a competitor.
What does that have to do with the Section 20 question? There are accounting rules for when you have to account for a partially owned firm in a particular way. Have we held that those accounting rules control the outcome of a Section 20 claim?
No, and we're not arguing
Has
that.
Has anybody else held that?
No, we're not arguing that, Your Honor. We're arguing they had practical
control.
Why did you
answer my question that way?
Well, I didn't. That was not my intent. My intent was to show that the results of CBAS's liquidity were critical to Magic. They were about to merge with the other 46% owner.
But they didn't. Let me make it concrete. Have we or another circuit held that when there are two equal minority owners of an entity, that Section 20 applies to that entity?
Your Honor, I am not aware of a precise case on point by the Seventh Circuit. I know I have had other cases myself in which far lower percentages of ownership were deemed sufficient for control.
Not following my question. It's pretty well understood that a 46% owner, when the rest of the shares are scattered, is in control. Here we've got two equal minority owners, and my question was, has any court held that when there are two equal minority owners, the entity is a controlled entity under Section 20? Because that, of course, implies that it was equally controlled by the other 46% owner.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not aware of a court that has been addressed with that precise fact scenario.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, Your Honor, just to get back, we are faced with a somewhat odd procedural posture in that what had occurred is that these two SEC transcripts were produced after the district court had ruled. We're on a motion, among other things, appeal of a motion to deny leave to amend on futility grounds. And those two transcripts demonstrate all of the facts that Your Honors have raised here in court, in fact, existed.
Do you have those facts without the SEC transcripts? Prior to receiving those, did you have enough?
Your Honor, in our view, we have facts from which reasonable inferences can be drawn. The information in the SEC transcripts are direct evidence out of the mouths of the defendants themselves. So certainly the quality of the information pales in comparison to that which was produced in the SEC transcripts. In the SEC transcripts, for example, Draghi admits that he was told in June and early July by the lenders that they were marking the assets against the ABX index. And both Draghi and Williams testified that when they learned that, they knew that the jig was up, they had a problem, because the ABX index had dropped 20% between July 1st and July 19th. 20% when you have $6 billion of assets translates into a loss of value of in excess of $1 billion. They only had $150 million in cash, and $100 million of that came from their parents 2 days earlier. None of this was disclosed to investors at the same time that Williams and Draghi Magic is issuing a press release saying that Seabass has substantial liquidity to meet margin calls, assuming there's not further deterioration in the market, and where Draghi and Williams are stating that they can access the market, that they have delivered, that they have $150 million in cash, that the asset values incorporate lenders' marks. And, Your Honor, this was all a calculated scheme to mislead, because Williams and Draghi owned 8%, along with the other Seabass officers, owned 8% of the stock of Seabass. They were attempting to outrun the market because Magic and Radian and Seabass were working to sell 50% of the stock of Seabass to outside investors. So if they were able to do that, even though they knew because of the drop in the ABX index and the unprecedented rate of $145 million in margin calls, that they were going to be socked with hundreds of millions of dollars more in margin calls based upon the facts that were known on July 19th, They were hoping that they could accomplish the sale.
But what would a reason? Let's look at a reasonable investor. And why would a reasonable investor assume from Draghi's statement that $150 million would necessarily be ample?
Your Honor, I believe, with all due respect, that that's not the test for materiality.
No, you don't want to ever say with all due respect.
I'm sorry. That means if you weren't such a, if you weren't a judge, I'd call you a jerk.
No, I know you
would never do that.
Okay. No. I'm sorry. I truly did not intend that. What I had wanted to say was that the materiality.
I understand that. But I'm trying to get at why you feel so strongly. Look, they had the amount of cash available, and that may seem simplistic. They had that $150 million, regardless of where they got it. And nothing that he said, nothing that they said, it seems to me, registers as false about that.
Well, Your Honor, these almost identical facts were presented to the district court in Solo versus Citigroup. In Solo versus Citigroup, the statements that were made.
You know, opinions of district courts around here and 250 will get you a cup of coffee. They have no precedential force at all.
I understand that, Your Honor. I was simply citing to the reasoning of the district court, which I thought might be persuasive to Your Honors. And the reasoning of that court was that when you say that I have substantial liquidity, or when Citibank said I have substantial liquidity, but the source of that liquidity was distress financing from the Federal Reserve because the Citigroup had no other alternative to raise money, that fact, judged by the generous standards for determining whether facts are material, could be found by an investor to be very important because it suggests that the borrower is in desperate liquidity straits. And in as of July 19th, Seabass's competitors were all going out of business because they had inadequate liquidity. Liquidity was life or death for a subprime company on July 19, 2007. We were at the height of the subprime crisis, and the difference
July
between...
July 2007 was the height of this crisis?
Of the subprime crisis, not of the credit crisis. The overall credit crisis hit several months later. But for purposes of the subprime crisis, what you saw, in fact, the news reports of July 18th, which are cited in our complaint, the day before this conference call, says the ABX index, which is a composite of subprime securities, was at a record low. It had dropped 50%. Since January 1st, 2007. All right. So that if you were to mark $6 billion of assets based upon the market price, you'd have to drop it by 50%, would be billions of dollars. Right? So that if Seabass had to sell its assets to raise cash to pay the margin calls, it could not possibly be profitable in the rest of 2007, and it could not survive. Since Magic had a $500 million stake in Seabass, and the sale of Seabass's stock was a linchpin for the Radian merger, these were critical facts. And when they became, and when Seabass collapsed as a result of the additional margin calls, Magic stock dropped 30%. This is all happening in July of 2009.
Your red light is going to be.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Ms. Caswan? Mr. House?
Brian House, law firm Foley & Lardner for the MGIC defendants, which is the MGIC Investments Corporation, Kirk Culver, and J. Michael Lauer.
All right, let me just start you right out. Because,
yes, Judge.
Substantial liquidity is irrelevant.
Please don't touch the microphone. If you want it higher, you should raise the podium. There is a switch on the right-hand side.
Okay.
The right-hand side.
Apologies.
Okay. I forgot.
You were asking me about substantial liquidity, Judge.
Thank you. Okay, yeah, so substantial liquidity is a relative concept. Am I right?
Is a relative concept?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So, given the size of CBAS's highly leveraged portfolio, how could $150 million have constituted sufficient liquidity for even a modest downward adjustment in the asset valuation by the CBAS lenders?
I think the key is that substantial liquidity is one thing, sufficient liquidity is another. You change the term, and that's the point of the disclosure. The substantial liquidity disclosure was in a set of risk factors that was paragraph after paragraph of warnings of the risks involved in CBAS's business. And the phrase substantial liquidity was just one statement that was immediately followed by the precise warning that it may not be sufficient to meet CBAS's liquidity needs. So when you look at the statement in the whole, the point of our argument is that the statement made was not misleading. It's just like in the Donald Trump casino case that we cited. This isn't a case where the misleading statement was buried, the risks were buried. This is a case where the purportedly misleading statement was buried. And that's why all of the warnings were there that this could be, that the liquidity at CBAS could be, in fact, be insufficient. The very specific and precise risks were disclosed.
I have been wondering about this. Did MAGIC have authority to instruct CBAS what to say during the July 19th conference call?
There's certainly no allegation to that effect, Your Honor. I mean, I think Judge Easterbrook had it correct. There's no question that MGIC invited Mr. Williams and Mr. Draghi to the conference call. But that doesn't suggest control. It doesn't suggest agency. There's simply nothing in the allegations of these complaints that suggest that there was any control. And that gets us into the entire discussion about Janus, about who made the statements. These are all arguments specific to MGIC that sitting in that conference call, the MGIC defendants did not make these statements. And while we certainly don't think that anything that was said was misleading.
You know, you suggested in the brief that if MAGIC had predicted the forthcoming flood of margin calls, it wouldn't have extended the unsecured $50 million loan.
Well, that's certainly true.
To CBAS. But if MAGIC was simply trying to prop up CBAS long enough for the merger with Radian, the loan would make perfect sense, wouldn't it?
I could see that argument, Judge, but I don't think, when you look at the overall picture, I don't think it's plausible. Because here you have CBAS entering into an acquisition. CBAS acquired a subprime mortgage originator on July 17th. And so it makes perfect sense that a 46% owner would assist in that acquisition. Now, there is no question that CBAS their timing couldn't have been worse. But the allegations in the complaints make clear that CBAS doggedly pursued the subprime mortgage originator Fieldstone, in fact, didn't walk away from the transaction, and paid a couple hundred million dollars on July 17th to enter into that transaction. So the loan makes sense.
Did Magic's balance sheet show the $50 million loan?
Magic's balance sheet did show the $50 million loan, I believe. One of the responses from Fulton is that, well, the Janus case isn't relevant because Williams and Draghi were agents of MGIC. And that just simply cannot be the case. As Judge Easterbrook pointed out, you invite someone to your conference call. You're not in control of them. You do not have any kind of authority that would allow the agency analysis.
You could be in principle. That is, you could have an agreement with them by contract that they'll submit to you, clear with you in advance what they say.
There's no question.
But I gather there's no such allegation made in either the original or the proposed amended complaint.
There are no such allegations. Plaintiffs in their reply brief say that they could plausibly plead that Williams and Draghi were agents, but that doesn't quite work. As this court said,
that's standard anyway.
I'm sorry?
Plausible pleading is not the TELAB standard.
Well, it's not the TELAB standard, and it's not the Lackman versus ADM Investor Services standard, which says that you apply 9B, the specificity rules for pleading, in a case where you're trying to plead a fraud through an agency relationship. Otherwise, it would simply be too easy to say that an agent committed a fraud, and of course, a principal was responsible. The Section 28 claims, just a word about those, Fulton alleges in its brief that MGIC was the control person. And they concede that that's a new theory that wasn't articulated in either of these pleadings, but they say they clearly could plead such a violation. And they ask this court to remand for purposes of doing so. And we just think that's entirely inappropriate. They've had multiple chances to plead a 28 claim, just like they've had multiple chances to plead, a primary liability claim, and they can't come to this court with the further promise to plead a viable claim with respect to primary liability or secondary liability under Section 28 on remand. The Global Crossing case and the Isilon Systems cases get to the point that the court raised earlier, which is simple minority shareholder control. Even if you have the ability to appoint directors or remove directors, it doesn't get you to Section 20A. With respect to the matrix, citation to the matrix case, we strongly disagree that we're really talking about the matrix paradigm here. I mean, really, this is about whether the statements made were misleading. Fulton would have us believe that we're trying to dismiss the case based on materiality grounds, but that's not really it. The issue that we are raising is whether the statements made, considered in context, were misleading by virtue of this alleged omitted information. Finally, a point about the state of the record. Ms. Caswan cited to these SEC transcripts, which are extremely voluminous. As she said, they are now pending before the district court on a 60B motion, which is where we think they belong. This court's the rules, federal rules of civil procedure, the rules of appellate procedure, and this court's cases suggest that in a fraud case like this, you simply cannot go outside the pleadings on appeal. That they should be bound by the pleadings, and they can't supplement those pleadings on appeal and argue the specificity needed in a fraud case, particularly a PSLRA case from there. And the Venrock case we brought to the court's attention, we think that governs, and the PSLRA merely reinforces that point. So for these reasons, one final comment about Sienter. Absent these agency theories and their attempt to impute liability to our clients, the MGIC defendants, we really don't think they can show Sienter. I mean, this case is all about trying to impute liability because the allegations and the complaints don't suggest Sienter. But this court's decision in the Pew versus Tribune Co., for example, says it's simply not that easy. You can't simply get to from a subsidiary to the parent company as easily as plaintiffs would suggest for purposes of liability under Rule 10b-5. And that's even more so here when we're not talking about a parent subsidiary context. We're talking about a 46% owner. So we ask that the district court judgment be affirmed for all these reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. House. Mr. Fuhrer?
May it please the court, Ed Fuhrer from Hunt and Williams, and I will be brief this morning on behalf of Appalese, Mr. Williams, and Mr. Draghi. Let me just pick up on the point that Ms. Williams discussed with her primary focus on liquidity. The argument and the implication in her briefs is that the defendants, individually or collectively, assured investors that there was sufficient liquidity to address what may come. That is not what the defendants said. The defendants were specific. They indicated exactly how much liquidity they had. They provided that number, $150 million. They didn't just say it's significant. They actually gave the hard number. In addition, in the discussions by Mr. Williams and Magic at that time, there were repeated discussions about the liquidity issues that were facing all subprime participants, and that would obviously include CBATs. And Mr. Williams on July 19th indicated that liquidity remains a primary issue for all subprime participants, that there were increased margin calls from all lenders. And this comes on the heels of the first quarter where CBATs had paid $200 million in margin calls, which had been fully disclosed. Moreover, on July 19, in the press release that Magic issued, Magic expressly warned that, you know, while we have this liquidity, the liquidity that we have, we cannot guarantee that all liquidity required will, in fact, be available. So the very risk that ultimately manifested was specifically disclosed. And the actual statements and facts that were issued by these defendants were all entirely accurate. And the last comment that I would address very briefly is with respect to valuation. Ms. Williams said that lenders' values are what is critical and that that's all that matters, except that's not what Mr. Williams said. Mr. Williams said in his statement that there was actually a much more complex valuation approach that CBAS took that looked at a variety of things. It looked at transactions, looked at lenders' values, and most importantly, looked at their internal modeling on a month-to-month basis, bond-by-bond basis, and looked at a lot of the details and granularity and looked at how all that fit together and when there were differences would work to resolve those differences. So the CBAS valuation was not hinged strictly to lenders. CBAS never said that it was. So unless there are any further questions, I will rest there and thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fuhrer. Anything further, Ms. Catalan?
Your Honor, first, so that there's no confusion, the $50 million was not included on Magic's balance sheet as of June 30th because the loan was made after June 30th. With respect to the statements about the warning that there was no guarantee that liquidity would be sufficient, that warning was given word for word in each of the risk disclosures made in the 2006 10-K, the April 11th, 2007 press release, and the July 19th, 2007 press release. As this court held in Asher versus Baxter, that is a sign that the warnings are meaningless. When the risks change dramatically, which is what occurred here, but the warning remains the same, it means that the warning is not telling investors anything. Here, Your Honor, the other point with respect to asking whether or Your Honor's, Judge Easterbrook, your
Thank
comment
you,
about...
Thank you, counsel. Case is taken under advisement.